At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The inferno that is the state of Colorado is prompting many of us to ask the simple question, would I be ready? What would I take with me if I had just hours, maybe minutes, to leave a place I might never see again? Because that is what's facing families and businesses throughout the West. And we're about to hear from one beloved place that just lost everything. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 27th day of June. The wildfires in Colorado are now so vast and intense, officials can no longer estimate how much damage has been done. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated, including those at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. The Waldo Canyon Fire and the Hyde Park Fire have burned hundreds of homes to the ground, and as of yesterday, the Flying W Ranch is also gone. The Western-themed resort has been around for more than 50 years. It provided authentic cowboy food and entertainment to 1,200 people on any given night. Aaron Winter is an employee at the Flying W. We caught him on his cell phone in Colorado Springs. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, unfortunately, there was a fire that started back on Saturday. But yesterday, the fire had actually broken through Queens Canyon, came up the mountain ridge but directly behind us, and ignited the entire mountaintop. And within, I'd say, about 5 minutes, it had actually engulfed the entire side of the mountain, traveling down at least at 60 miles per hour towards the Flying W, as well as the surrounding community of Mountain Shadows.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of the Flying W. Tell us about Marion and Russ Wolf, the founders.
Well, you know, Marion and Russ actually started the Flying W back in 1953. They would actually cook all the food out in their backyard. And Marion was always the cook. She was a wonderful lady. Unfortunately, she did pass away in 1999. But her husband, Russ, is still alive today. And we actually got him evacuated just yesterday as well. We're hoping that his house is still standing, but we're not entirely sure.
How do you deal with something like this as a business? I mean, obviously you had insurance, you know, you knew that this was a possibility of happening just by where you were, but recovery has got to be just a really long process now as you look into the future.
It does. You know, we can only, you know, go one step at a time. Thankfully, also on Saturday, we managed to get out a lot of the antiquities that were in a lot of our shops and our buildings. So when the plan is if we can rebuild, you know, we'll go ahead and return all that stuff back to the Flying W. It obviously won't be the same, but, you know, we will still have the same staff. We'll still have the same wranglers, and, you know, we'll still have some of the original stuff from the Flying W.
How long have you worked there?
I've been there for 15 years now. I actually started in May of 1997.
So what does the place mean to you?
It means the world to me. When it was burning, we were all basically, you know, hugging each other and, you know, tears streaming down our face. But our biggest concern, obviously, is to the homes that are located around us and to those people that have lost everything that they've gathered over the years. And we just want to send out our love to them. We know that everybody cares about the Flying W, but, you know, they're also highly important to us.
Aaron Winter is Director of Sales and Marketing at the Flying W Ranch in Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you, and thanks for calling us.
And on Wall Street, oil and energy stocks helped the Dow to a positive day. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Mexico chooses a new president on Sunday. Voters could stick with the ruling conservative PAN party, or they may reinstate the old PRI party, which was in power for decades. Or they could go with Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the leftist whose PRD party came in second last time around. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler checked in with some Mexican-American voters stateside to get their thoughts on what kind of change might be chosen.
From a cramped room in a Los Angeles church, Bertha Rodriguez uses Skype to make cold calls, reaching out to voters in Tijuana. She recommends the leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who placed second in the last presidential election. She sees him as a needed change from the current party, which has ruled for the past 12 years. Rodriguez ends the call saying,
"Think about us who had to leave Mexico because of the difficult situation that you're living in there."
After she hangs up, I ask why people like Rodriguez had to leave her home state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico.
Unemployment, the economic crisis, the NAFTA.
Shifting to Spanish, Rodriguez elaborates on the impact of free trade.
The products that come from Canada and the United States, the fruits and vegetables, ruin the local economy. There was no work.
She would like to see Mexico's economy develop to the point that its citizens don't need to emigrate. At this furniture store in downtown Los Angeles, I hear almost the same message from the owner, Beatrice Ricarte.
We would like migration to be a choice, not because you have to go somewhere else to change your quality of life.
She supports PAN, the current party in power. But her vote would still represent a change, at least in gender.
I support the woman, Josefina Vázquez Mota.
One of the things Ricarte likes about candidate Vázquez Mota, she's an economist.
Right now, the economy in Mexico is growing at 5%, so definitely we want the economy to continue growing.
If the economy is doing so well, why is there such discontent with the status quo? I put that question to Gladys Pinto when we met at a Mexican restaurant in Pasadena.
To me, personally, the things have gotten worse because before, we didn't have that many killings. Mexico was safe.
She blames the party now in power for the violence in Mexico. The current president used the army to go after corrupt cops and drug cartels, and the resulting bloodbath has left about 50,000 people dead.
We would like to go back, you know, someday to live in Mexico. And we want a prosperous Mexico. We don't want a Mexico like the one we have now that is not safe to travel.
For her, change means a return to the past. Pinto supports PRI, the party that dominated Mexican politics for 70 years. She says it's not fair for people to saddle PRI's candidate, the front runner Enrique Peña Nieto, with the sins of the party's corrupt past.
They think the whole party is the same, and no, it's not.
In the kitchen, Mexican men chop onions and make guacamole. Because of cumbersome bureaucratic hurdles for expatriates, most of these guys can't vote for president. Out of some 12 million Mexicans living in the U.S., only about 50,000 are registered to vote. The manager of El Portal restaurant could vote, but Ramon Arellano is disappointed with past campaign promises.
They promised in a lot of things, and then nothing happened, and the poor people are still poorer and poorer, and the rich people richer and richer.
No matter who gets elected president in Mexico, he expects no significant changes. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Today is a day that will live in the history books of Stockton, California, population 292,000. It is now the latest and largest U.S. city to declare bankruptcy. Under a budget approved by the city council last night, it will default on more than $10 million in debt payments. Stockton sits in the middle of what's often called America's Salad Bowl, California's Central Valley, about 80 miles east of San Francisco. The city was also an index case for the housing crisis. Kathy Miller is the vice mayor and joins us now to talk about what this all means. Welcome.
Thank you.
How long have you lived there in Stockton?
About 15 years.
Okay, so you've been there for quite a while. I know that this bankruptcy news has been coming, so it's not exactly unexpected. But what's the sense there today now that it's happening?
Well, it's kind of twofold. I think for the public, there's still a lot of fear of the unknown. And for the folks primarily in the business community, I think there's a little bit of feeling of relief that now we've taken this step, we can get down to business of recovery.
Who will be feeling the brunt of most of this?
Well, at this point, I think the brunt of who's going to be contributing to the solution now are our bondholders and our retirees.
And what does it mean for them?
Well, for our retirees, the council made the decision that it was more important to protect the pensions of all. And so those retirees who have been receiving free lifetime medical benefits for themselves and spouse will now have to pay for that benefit.
What about just basically the citizens of Stockton? What does this mean for them as the city goes into bankruptcy? How does it affect city services, taxes?
Well, I think the most important thing is for the people here, this pendency plan reinforces our commitment to not reducing services to the public any further. For the last 3.5 years, it's the residents and our current employees that have borne the brunt of the cuts. Mm-hmm. Our employees, their compensation has been reduced anywhere from between 9% and 22%. Our workforce is down. 23% of our police officers, 30% of our firefighters, and 43% of our other non-safety public employees. That translates to a direct reduction in services that the people living here have already experienced. These people have already given. It's my belief that if these very generous pensions and health care retiree benefits had been fully costed out at the time they were granted, it would have been immediately apparent that they were not affordable.
Kathy Miller is the vice mayor of Stockton, California, which is now in bankruptcy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
So Stockton is certainly having its share of trouble, but another formerly struggling town is looking up, New Orleans. The Brookings Institution has been tracking the 100 biggest metropolitan areas to see how well they've recovered from the recession. It crunches numbers for job creation, unemployment rate, real estate values, and more. And as of the first quarter of this year, the top slot goes to the Big Easy. At the bottom, Little Rock, Arkansas. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what is behind the ups and downs.
This report doesn't tell us where there's the most job growth, the least unemployment.
This is not America's best communities. This is what's the progress of the recovery like in metropolitan America today?
Alan Berube at the Brookings Institution says there are places at the top of the list that never really crashed and are still doing well. Austin and Houston, Texas. Go 1,500 miles north to Michigan's old Rust Belt, and there are also winners.
Detroit is the home of the big three, but a lot of sophisticated advanced manufacturing in Grand Rapids absolutely pummeled during the recession and even the lead up to the recession. But manufacturing and exports of manufactured goods have been one of the strongest drivers.
Another driver, domestic energy, oil or natural gas, drilled or fracked or piped. Mike Conway runs the Mahoning Valley Economic Development Corporation in the formerly dying steel town of Youngstown, Ohio. It's ranked 10th for recovery. Conway says they've got parts suppliers rushing in to support the booming natural gas industry.
We're also seeing manufacturing activity locating here directly to supply the drilling activity. The first significant steel-related expansion in the past 30 years.
Same story down in the Gulf, where New Orleans and Houston are both riding a wave of oil and petrochemicals. So who brings up the rear? Again, Alan Berube.
Madison, Wisconsin, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Jackson, Mississippi, Honolulu, Hawaii.
Notice a pattern? State capitals. While the private sector has been steadily adding to payrolls, tight budgets have sent government employment down by more than 500,000 jobs since the economy hit bottom. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, the white working class vote is important to politicians, but who are we talking about?
I am dependent on a lot of government services, from food stamps to health care. But on the other hand, I have a lot of conservative ideals.
But first, let's do the numbers. Summit, schmummit. A day before European leaders hold crisis talks, the Dow rallied 92 points, 0.75% to close at 12,627. The Nasdaq added 21 points, also 0.75% to finish at 2,875. And the S&P 500 rose 11 points, 0.9% to end the day at 1,331. Signs that the housing market is finally finding its footing pushed shares higher. Home builder Lennar climbed 4.75%. KB Home picked up 3%. Rising oil prices buoyed energy stocks. Chevron fueled up 1.6%, while fellow blue chip ExxonMobil gained 1%. The day's big gainer, however, was Arena Pharmaceuticals. Its shares closed up nearly 29% after the FDA approved its pill to treat obesity. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.62%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its final gross domestic product report for the first quarter. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton travels to St. Petersburg, Russia, where she'll attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation's Women and the Economy Forum. And the multi-talented comedian Mel Brooks turns 86. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdal. Down through history, governments have used something known as the power of eminent domain to seize private property in the name of the greater public good. If the government wants to clear the way for a new highway, for example, it can force you to give up your home for fair compensation. Now, some enterprising investors are suggesting a totally new twist on that idea to jumpstart the housing recovery in some of the country's most distressed areas. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has that story.
There's a big roadblock to economic recovery in Southern California's San Bernardino County. Standing in the way is a whole mess of mortgages that are out of whack with home values. So officials are now considering using their power to clear away those troublesome loans by seizing them.
It's kind of the flip side, using eminent domain not to take people from their homes, but to keep people in their homes.
Greg Devereaux is the county's chief administrative officer. He thinks it might be possible to force through thousands of affordable mortgages instead of waiting for lenders to renegotiate with homeowners or evict them.
I'm intrigued by the idea, as is my board of supervisors, because it's the first thing that we have been approached about that has the potential on sufficient scale to actually affect the market and the economy.
So here's the pitch officials are exploring. A group of venture capitalists wants the county to use its eminent domain authority to seize mortgages funded by private investors, not banks. It's those privately held mortgages that have been especially tough to renegotiate. The venture capital firm would buy out the original lenders, and the homeowner would get a new mortgage at the lower property value. That new loan would then be resold to other investors.
This sounds like an incredible can of worms.
Attorney John Peterson specializes in eminent domain cases here in Los Angeles. He says the original lenders could tie up the whole plan in a legal battle over what's fair compensation, not to mention the fair use of government power.
If the purpose is to acquire them through the public power and then turn them over to private property owners or a private venture group, is that going to pass the scrutiny of the court in terms of public use and necessity?
The firm floating this idea argues the public benefit is obvious. Stephen Gluckstern heads Mortgage Resolution Partners based in San Francisco. He says sure his investment group would make a fee on each restructured loan, but he insists the motive goes far beyond the profit potential.
This isn't a group of people that came together to say, can we think of another way to make money? This is a group of people that came together and said, can we solve what is an intractable problem that's holding back a recovery in this country? And that's what I think we've done.
Gluckstern says Mortgage Resolution Partners is pitching the idea to officials in a handful of hard-hit states. L.A. Attorney John Peterson is skeptical about the as-yet-untried approach.
I could see politicians may argue that it has a noble purpose, but I think, as with so many issues, the devil is in the details, and it will be surprising if this program is implemented anytime soon.
For now, San Bernardino County says it's merely studying the idea. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
As the economic recovery slows, and that is what it's looking like these days, so goes consumer confidence. How are people feeling about things these days?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's here every week to give us an attitude check on what Americans really think about the economy and other issues of the day. Frank, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
All right, let's talk consumer confidence. How are folks feeling about the economy?
Not good.
Uh-oh. All right, so where does that put us?
Well, let me quantify it for you first. Our economic confidence measure is minus 26, and you ask what that means. Well, zero would be where things were on an even keel. So that minus 26 means we're underwater attitudinally. Not as bad as it could get. It was minus 65 back in 08, but the minus 26 is negative, not positive.
Do we know why there's been this dip at this point in the year?
You know, that's an excellent question, and a lot of us are scratching our head. We've done a lot of analysis. Typically, there is a correlation between consumer confidence and the Dow, but the Dow generally, after dropping at the beginning of the month, has been up, so that's not working.
Right.
Gas prices have been getting a lot better, and yet consumer confidence has been getting worse, so that's not predicting much. What we think it may relate to is news. We do know from some research we've done it's related to the sentiment in the news. There's a European crisis going on, and we really think there may be some implications of what's going on in Washington. Uncertainty, waiting for the health care ruling, problems with Congress not acting, and all the things that may happen later in the year in the election. That may be part of why consumers aren't all that confident, and they're probably still worried about jobs.
Yeah, so there's just basically, it sounds like a general sense of unease has returned. So what are the ramifications of that?
Politically, there are interesting ramifications. Our work shows that President Obama would want to have this index at about a minus 15 because that predicts about a 50% job approval rating.
Hmm.
So if consumer sentiment remains lower below that level as it is now, that's not a good predictor for his reelection probability. Whether or not it means consumers won't spend, which is what a lot of people assume, is a little less clear in the data.
All right. Well, we've still got what? 4 or 5 months till the election. So is there anything in the polling that suggests this might change at all?
You know, the direction of the economy is one of the components of our consumer confidence, and we now have 58%, count it, 58% of Americans say the economy is getting worse, not better, and that's not the kind of measure an incumbent president would like to have. And now whether that'll change or not, I think we're going to wait and see. We've got the health care ruling. We have a week from Friday, the announcement of the June unemployment number, so a lot of new information will come in. But right now, we don't know whether it'll change, but it's not auspicious for President Obama.
All right. Looking into that crystal ball there. Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Remember the soccer mom, the NASCAR dad, security moms, office park dads? Oh, we do love our election cycle swing voter cliches. Well, this year, from the right to the left and all across the media, there's been a lot of talk about the role of one group.
White working class voters.
White working class voters.
White working class voters are so central.
But there's just one problem. No one can agree on exactly who these people are or how they're feeling. Chrissy Clark has more from our Wealth and Poverty Desk.
When you hear white working class, maybe you picture a big guy wearing
T-shirt and jeans, steel-toed boots, that sort of thing.
That's Michael Haywood of Kelso, Washington, describing himself. Never finished college, drives a dump truck, struggles on $40,000 a year. He's white.
And I would definitely consider myself working class.
50 years ago, he'd be a pretty good shoe-in for a Democrat. But now, he's torn.
I am dependent on a lot of government services, from food stamps to health care. But on the other hand, I have a lot of conservative ideals.
There's been a lot of time spent theorizing about guys like Haywood, white working-class voters who over the last few decades have been eyeing the right. Is it a sign that the country's divided between Prius-driving liberals and conservatives in pickup trucks?
Ah!
That's Andrew Gelman, a political science professor at Columbia University.
I just got a little frustrated. It's not the Prius versus the pickup truck. It's the Prius versus the Hummer.
The real polarization in politics, Gelman says, doesn't happen between rich and poor. It happens between different kinds of rich. Low-income workers still do vote overwhelmingly Democratic, just not blue-collar white guys like Mike Haywood. But Gelman says they make up a much smaller slice of the low-income workforce these days, as it turns more female and more diverse. So Gelman wonders, why still focus so much on just one working-class subgroup?
You know, everybody's vote just counts once, right? A white male vote isn't more legitimate than a minority vote or a female vote.
Still, it is worth paying attention to white working-class men, says Charles Murray of the American Enterprise Institute.
The really interesting thing about voting in the white working class isn't whether it's Democratic or Republican. It's the degree to which it's declined.
And in a close election, if one party can re-engage those voters, it could make all the difference. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, a look to tomorrow and the Supreme Court's expected ruling on the Affordable Health Care Act. Whether you're in the media, a patient with a pre-existing condition, or even President Obama himself, you are probably keen to find out, will the court uphold it, get rid of it, some of it, all of it? Well, for an early hint, we turn to some other kind of experts to see where things might be headed. We talk to astrologists. First, Randy Goldberg in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I think it's definitely 100% is going to be they're going to keep all of it.
But then here is astrologer Craig Martin from Los Angeles.
From looking at the charts here, that they're going to probably just take out the individual mandate and leave the rest of the law intact.
Okay, well, all of this has to do, apparently, with whether Venus will be in retrograde or not tomorrow, which these two do not agree on. So I guess we will all just have to wait. And that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow rallied 92 points, 0.75%. The Nasdaq added 21 points, also 0.75%. And the S&P 500 rose 11 points, 0.9%. Our engineers include Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Cologne, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.